You're listening to CPC Together, a podcast produced by Central Peninsula Church in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Oh. All right, well, welcome back to CPC Together. This is really exciting to be here with two monumental men.
Wow.
Ebenezers, so to speak. Can a human be an Ebenezer? I guess in the case of Scrooge.
Yeah, and yeah. But I don't think that's you're using that term the way that you know it.
Isn't Ebenezer the one we sing in Come Thou Fount? It's like
I raise my Ebenezer.
Isn't it sort of a monument type of thing?
I think so.
I have no idea what it is.
Yeah, I think you just sing it. I think it's like a touchstone, like a mark.
Anyway, I am here with Mr. Mark Mitchell, Dr. Mark Mitchell, and
good doctor,
and nearly Dr. Kevin Sneed.
Nearly is very generous. We're still a long way away, but we're making progress.
Attempting doctor.
Attempting, that's better.
Kevin Sneed. And Mark, it's so good to have you back on Sunday.
Yeah. Oh, thanks. It was great to be there. It was fun. Great to see some old friends that I haven't seen for quite a while, and just to be back. It was awesome.
Yeah. So you got to help us understand a little bit. So, I mean, you said you were here, you've been here half your life.
Right. And no, I said over half my life.
Over half your life. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
since I said 35 years on Sunday, he wants to just clarify over half the life.
So when you're here for that long and then you leave for a year and a half and come back, that's gotta feel a little weird. Like what was happening in your head coming back? And I know you were giving Kevin space and stuff for that year and a half and that kind of thing, but what was happening in you? Like, was it odd? Was it?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think it helped that it's not the first time I've been back to CPC in a year and a half. I stop by here every once in a while. You know, we have pastoral residence here. I still get mail here. So it's not like it's the first time I've been back. And I also did a memorial service here probably about a year ago. So, you know, that helps. But of course, coming back on a Sunday morning is a big deal, and it's different. And I was looking forward to it for a long time, and it was really good to see some friends that I just don't normally see unless I come to church here. And and it was really good, because the one thing I've missed more than anything is Brandon Passion's worship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that makes sense.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Just being back and hearing the man lead us was fantastic. And, you know, and even better than that, you know, his wife as well. And so it was,
it's fair.
It was really fun. Yeah.
I told Katie, I said, you have to sing this Sunday, whatever you've got going on, because Mark is coming back. And she's like, okay.
Absolutely. That's awesome. Yeah. It was a necessity that she be there.
Yeah. But Mark actually requested that when we got the date finally. He's like, I will not preach unless Katie's singing.
I'm glad you got that right then.
Yeah, you did. You got it right.
What happened on Sunday, I just don't want, for all you listeners, I don't want you to miss just sort of the big thing that happened on Sunday. As I was watching in that first service, Kevin introducing Mark in like you said, Kevin, in the same way that he introduced you a year and a half. And I don't know if people know, and this is unfortunate, but how hard these transitions tend to be and how poorly many of them go. A lot of churches really struggle in this transition, and I'm sure it wasn't easy. But man, from the outside looking in, it just seemed like you guys it was the easiest thing in the world, just from one guy to the next. You had a long runway, Kevin, and Mark, you were so respectful and so gracious of Kevin and then coming back. But what has the transition been like, maybe on both of your ends? Like,
I'm going to let Mark go first.
Yeah, I think one of the things that was really helpful was that I think we had a lot of time to prepare for it.
Yeah.
I had started thinking about this because I'd been at CPC for so long. you know, I had some time to think about this. And not only that, I also had some time to watch other churches do this poorly. Mm-hmm. And so I really, it was really important to me to do it well. Mm-hmm. And I read some books on it. I talked to some other pastors about it. Tried to figure out, you know, what are some of the best practices in something like this. And for the most part, we went through that process. And I think that having had that time and that preparation really helped a lot. And it helped me, I think, as well on a personal level to prepare for the change that would come in my life. One of the things that I'm learning is that, and this is going to sound kind of negative, and I don't mean it to be, but the reality is the process of getting older is, or part of the process of getting older is dealing with loss. Mm-hmm. And that's mm-hmm. just a reality. You know, you lose friends, you lose jobs, you lose this and that. And in some ways, as a pastor, you lose your identity. And so I had some time to prepare for that. That was really helpful for me. It's not that it's easy necessarily, but it made it easier, I think, for me. And then also just having the opportunity to sort of pass the baton to somebody like Kevin and to be able to know that, you know, I knew him well. He wasn't somebody we brought in from the outside. He was somebody that, you know, as everybody knows, he went through our residency program and he was on our staff and he knew us well. We knew him well. And so that also made things a lot easier for me and a lot more satisfying to me when it comes right down to it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, that's good. I think, you know, from my end, I think I resonate so much with having been like, I don't know, you know, I know we talked about this in the interview process and in the, you know, the initial stages of this. I don't know if I would have, like, having an outside person come in would have been such a different journey than it was for me being here and present. And so a lot of that for me was built on the trust I had, through life experience kind of gained with both the elder board and with you, Mark, that I don't see how, if that trust wasn't established and been tested, I think throughout, my years here, if that transition could have played out or play out the way it has. To me, so much of it has been built on that. Like, I don't think there was a moment where I doubted the support from both you and the elder board. And that, I mean, that has been it indispensable, you know, in this past year as I've floundered around and tried to find my footing and made mistakes and but had the freedom to do that. And I think there, you know, I think that the way that played out on two levels, for me is where, why we are where we are now is both with the staff kind of being that first level of your voice kind of, in passing that baton. I think there was so much buy-in there because of the respect they had for your position and your character and your decision-making process, that was huge. And then that mapped onto the congregation as well. And the graciousness, like, that the congregation has demonstrated, really stems from your kind of, again, that moment of you passing the baton when we sat on that stage a year and a half ago, was huge. And I think that's where, you know, when that moment was taking place, I went into, you know, what the word I think God had been giving me for so long has been steward, is how do I steward this role well? Because ultimately it's not mine. It's not yours. It's not like we talk about it often. It can sound cliche that this is Jesus's church. But the reality is it is, and it isn't ours. And I've just been, God's really been working in me this idea of how do I steward what has been handed to me, which ultimately was handed to you at some point. Mm-hmm. And it goes back all the way. I mean, again, that's the lineage of scripture. It's this church tradition, this faith we have is none of ours. We're standing on the shoulders of those who have preceded us, who then, you know, and vice versa all the way down until we get to Jesus. And so in that sense, in that very real sense, I've experienced that idea of this being Jesus' church in a way I'd never maybe theologically knew, but hadn't experienced like I have this past year. And I know that's your heartbeat. And I think I've seen that and that, I don't know. Yeah. That concept of stewarding what's been given to me, I think has been so, central. And that's something I learned from you and the elders and the way you guys have gone about ministry. So, yeah.
It's been good. I think just to add one thing to that, Brandon, I think one of the things that has been helpful for the transition at CPC is that we have always de-emphasized this idea that we're sort of a one-man show.
Yeah.
That we're an elder-led church at CPC, and the lead pastor has an important role to play, but he's part of a team. Mm-hmm. And it's not all about sort of this superstar mentality where the church is going to rise and fall with that one person. And so I think that's been pretty well ingrained into the people of CPC. And I think that also goes a long way to help us in a time like this.
Yeah. In an era where, honestly, celebrity pastor culture has it's never been easier to be a celebrity as a pastor or a worship leader. And I appreciate both of you guys, with all the things you've got going on and all the things that you have accomplished and built. Neither of you have an overwhelming, at least it doesn't seem, an overwhelming ego. That you have the ability and the humility to lay ego aside. And I did get that message loud and clear on Sunday that this is not Mark's church or Kevin's church, but that this is Jesus' church. And it may sound like a easy thing to say, but I really believe that. Mark, I wanted to go through your message a little bit. So good. And you started off with something that we've been talking about a lot, which is the table and how so many important moments in our lives happen around the table. And it's a more important thing than we often even consider. And you even said that Jesus was kind of always eating as he goes through and you watch him, going through the Gospels, that you could say he even ate his way through the Gospels. I'm curious, is this idea of food and feeding and that type of thing, is there a pretty big significance to that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there is. And that came out, of course, in the message in different ways, for sure. I think that, first of all, I love to eat. So I can resonate with that whole idea. I came from an Italian family, and so like food was like really important to us. And my wife is an amazing cook. She actually worked for Sunset Magazine as a chef for 14 years. So I get to enjoy the benefits of that. Yeah. And this idea that Jesus sort of ate his way through the Gospels. By the way, the Gospel of Luke, not Mark, which I taught from on Sunday, but the Gospel of Luke is known for that. If you look particularly at Luke's Gospel, you see Jesus kind of eating his way. And, you know, one of the things that Jesus himself said, he said, listen, you know, John the Baptist came and, you know, he didn't eat, he fasted and he didn't drink and you guys criticized him. And then he said, I come eating and drinking, and you guys criticize me. And so isn't it interesting that one of the things that Jesus was known for, even amongst his critics, was eating and drinking. Obviously, eating with the wrong kinds of people and drinking with the wrong kinds of people. So I just think it's really significant. And, you know, let's be honest. I mean, so much of our life revolves around those meals, those tables. And I think I don't mean to get into a tangent here, but I think one of the things that a lot of families, are missing today in today's world is sitting down on a regular basis and eating together, you know, and having that mealtime together where you talk and so forth. One of my favorite television programs, and this will date me a little bit, is Blue Bloods, you know, with Tom Selleck. It's kind of an old man's show, but I love it. My wife loves it too. But one of the great things about that show is every single episode, they gather around the table as a family and an extended family as well. And they just do that once a week. And I think people love that. And anyway, so yeah, I think that's a big deal in the Gospels, big deal in Jesus' life, and hopefully that came out on Sunday. Yeah.
Well, even as you were talking on Sunday, you made reference to how so many of the Jewish traditions and customs that we're carrying, essentially the story of God, were built around feasts, were built around right. meals, because there's something unique that happens around the table. Particularly, I think, and I love your admonition there to families. I think you're spot on too, of like how eating together, brings not just like we've turned eating into a sort of utilitarian thing where it's like, mm-hmm. I just got to scarf down some food to get some energy. Mm-hmm. But there's so much more that goes on when you sit at a table, and it's not always like, you know, I've been at plenty of meals, my own family very much included, where they weren't all joyous occasions, right? Where frustrations are vented, where pain points are expressed, and like, but all of that can be held together by a table. You know, like I remember my, one of the old pastors I used to work with would talk about how, the church is the place where you don't push away from the table. That you have to stay there. 'Cause at the dinner table with family, you got to work through stuff because the next dinner's coming.
Unless like, you're the Dutton family in Yellowstone. Either of you guys watch that?
Yeah.
They literally never finish a meal.
Yeah.
Beth gets like a bite in and then she storms out.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's great.
So they always go back to the table.
They always go back.
When Jesus comes and he feeds this crowd, you ask this question, why does he give us this bread of life? And your answer was that he was filled with so much compassion that it hurts. Which is such a this gut wrenching. I love picturing Jesus and loving us so much he hurts. And you see the same thing, that same kind of compassion. Just the week before when mm-hmm. we were talking about the deaf man, and he has that groan mm-hmm. As he's praying for the deaf man. And you can mm-hmm. there's this piece of Jesus that you see just how deep and how much he loves us. And as parents, I feel like we can kind of identify with that a little bit. He felt so much compassion for this crowd. It made me think of this last year. I got to go to the Philippines, with our piano player, Tony. And, one of the things I realized there very quickly is that, they'd never stop feeding you. First of all, especially if you're a big guy, they're like, oh, let's see how much
we can eat all the food.
Let's see how much we can get this guy to eat. But the other thing is that like, if there was like, the cardinal sin in the Philippines, it's refusing food, like, or a host refusing their guest food. Like no matter what state things are in, you're going to offer them food, even if you're only there for a second. And it made me think the whole thing that brought Jesus to this compassion was that they'd been traveling with him for 3 days. And he said, these people have to eat. Right?
Yeah, exactly. And I even think it doesn't come out well in the NIV translation, but in other translations, that word remained, they have remained with me for three mm-hmm. days, is emphasized. And apparently that's a rare word that speaks of a commitment, you know, of sort of like a loyalty. And I actually think Jesus recognizes that, hey, these people are not just here for a handout. These people are hungry for the truth. They're hungry for the life that I came to give. And they've stuck with me now for 3 days. I mean, imagine that. I mean, you know, when was the last time I went without food for 3 days because I was hungry for the truth? Mm-hmm. And so he, in a way, sort of commends them for that and wants to feed them, you know, wants to take care of that need that they have. And I think the point that I was trying to make is that, you know, Jesus cares about those things too. Mm. He cares about the physical as well as the spiritual. And, you know, I know that one thing for me is that like my default mode is to think that he is disappointed with me. Mm. And the fact is that when he sees me, he has compassion, you know, that's for me, that's transformational to understand that and to have that perspective that he sees me with the eyes of compassion, not with disappointment, you know?
Mm. Yeah. It'd be just that concept. And I hadn't seen that until you were just talking there of it. of it being more than just they were tagging along with me.
Yeah.
Like that, that emphasis of like the hunger for what Jesus was doing there.
Right.
I think it is profound. And I think that example, of when's the last time we went 3 days because we were longing for that. Like that's such a foreign concept to us.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, that's, I mean, in some ways that's, we're dancing around that issue of fasting, right? That thing loves to go off.
That happened yesterday, too.
It did. It did.
Mark's watch wants to say in the conversation.
He wants to pipe in there. But that's that concept of even like with fasting, which we're going to talk about in the fall as a church, is the connection between like the way we tap into our bodily desire for like hunger and using that to recognize, as Jesus does so brilliantly here, that yes, there's that physical need. We're going to meet that. But this is a part of a much larger thing. You know, let me give you water that you'll never thirst again.
Right, like, right.
He plays so much off those. And I think we've divorced the idea of kind of our physical nature and our spiritual nature as being a unified thing. And Jesus brilliantly gets that, you know, and as you said, he's meeting both of those things in this particular passage.
So his compassion, the compassion that he had so much that it hurts, was for both physical and spiritual needs. Is that what you're saying?
I would say so.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah.
I mean, because his concern, right, was like, if I send them away, they're gonna die on the side of the road.
Yeah,
like, they're not gonna
make
it.
They're not gonna make it home.
But yet, then he layers in beautifully a teaching about a deeper, you know, not, I don't even necessarily want to say a deeper need, but a spiritual need.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
I love that. So you get this scene of, again, the second time you said, Mark, the second time. They do this large scale feeding and you have the image of these disciples. You give us this image of them going out. Jesus gives it to them to go out. Jesus could have done it himself, or he could have, you know, manifested it to just fall on everybody, or there's probably a million ways he could do it, but he chooses to use the disciples to distribute the food. So you get this picture of them going, handing out stuff, going back to Jesus, getting more, you know, like you said, fish and chips, going back out, giving it more, continually coming back to Jesus. And you painted this picture of the Christian life that I think is actually really, really beautiful. But you said that he puts the ownership in the hands of the disciples, and he does it joyfully. Like you said that he had a smile on his face. You think that was probably Mark's opinion, but what makes you say that? Why joyfully?
Yeah, well, I, you know, the example I used in the message was of my son and fishing with him and watching him reel in the fish and the joy that gave me, you know, watching him catch his first fish as opposed to me just hauling the fish in myself. And, I think, you know, obviously I'm using a little bit of imagination there. Because it doesn't say that Jesus was smiling and laughing and whatever, but I really believe that he would have been, and I think that the satisfaction that the crowd experienced, I think the disciples also experienced in passing out the bread and the fish, and I think Jesus in a way experienced the same thing, and I just think he loves to use us. He doesn't have to, you know, but he loves to engage us in the process of distributing this good news and this life to others. I mean, that's really, when you think about it, that's the purpose of the church. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's why we're here and not in heaven, is because he has work for us to do. He has bread for us to pass out. Mm-hmm. And I think it does bring him great joy. I mean, Jesus said, frequently he talked about his own joy. You know, he said to his disciples in the upper room, you know, I want my joy to be made full in you, you know? And it's funny. I for years I've kept by my bed a little drawing of Jesus laughing. In fact, you know, his head is thrown back. I mean, he's got this massive smile on his face and it's clear that he's just having a great laugh. And, you know, why do we rarely think of Jesus that way?
Yeah.
And, I think he had great joy in watching them do this.
Yeah. You know, one of the things you brought out in that section too, was, you know, the disciples in their distributing, and part of their distribution, or what Jesus is doing with the disciples in their distributing the food, is breaking down those cultural barriers. And I thought, man, that was a really powerful section of your sermon where you talked through, like, they wouldn't have, I mean, they would have never eaten with a Gentile, and like to then get, and then when you talked about the scraps, and I'd never like thought through like just the, what we would call, they didn't have the concept of germs, but how that would have been then made unclean. Right. And the fact that they were handling that, like the, like, I wonder if the disciples started with a disgruntledness to do this. And then, as you said, slowly over time, they realized, oh my goodness, like what Jesus was doing in that moment. I don't know. I think there's something so profound, and you brought that, I think when you brought it full circle, and I don't want to skip ahead in the conversation too much, but that idea of it being both radically inclusive and exclusive was a really powerful moment. So I don't know. I don't know if there's any thoughts on that, but like, you know, the distinction between the feeding of the 5,000 for the, for the Gentile or the Jews, and the 4,000 here for the Gentiles, like talk a little bit about how radical that would have been and radically challenging for the disciples to do that.
Yeah, no, I think, as I said, Sunday, I think that that's the reason why Mark included the feeding of the 4,000.
Yeah.
I'm convinced of that, that it was a feeding of Gentiles. And yeah, I mean, I think that this is why the disciples don't bring up the hunger of the crowd, but Jesus brought up the hunger of the crowd, unlike in the first feeding.
Yeah.
And he took the initiative.
Yeah.
He said, I have compassion on these people. He didn't say that, you know, in the first one. It says he had compassion on them, but he doesn't say I have compassion on them. So there's just a lot of little clues, I think, in this Mark chapter 8 that tell us that that's what's going on. And
which also makes sense, because I think it's the next, I think it's the next verse, I'm preaching this Sunday on it, where the Pharisees begin to question.
Oh yeah.
Right. And they're ticked off.
That's right.
And
that's
the warning to the disciples is, hey, be careful.
Yeah.
This little seed of animosity towards the Gentiles will work its way through the whole dough.
Yeah.
So I
mean, this was as big of an issue. Consider this, that after Jesus ascended to heaven and the disciples are taking the gospel out, you know, to Judea, Samaria, and to the ends of the earth, that Peter decides that, you know what, I really can't any longer eat with Gentiles.
Mm-hmm.
Peter, the apostle Peter, who was there, he decides, I'm not going to eat with Gentiles anymore.
Yeah.
And the apostle Paul has to come to Galatia to confront him about that.
Yeah.
And say, you hypocrite.
Yeah.
You know this isn't the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
So this was that big of an issue for them.
Yeah.
You know, so consider here the disciples are, this is pre-crucifixion and resurrection. They don't even have the Holy Spirit in them at this point.
Yeah.
And yet Jesus is forcing them out of their little eggshells, and they have to go and they have to interact with these Gentile people. And I think it was hugely difficult for them. And again, I think it's a powerful message that Jesus came for all people, not just for insiders.
Yeah. So it said at the end of the feeding that everybody was satisfied, and, you know, you go on to tell us that, that really is sort of like the centerpiece of why we do what we do, that every man, I think you said every human on this planet has a deep soul craving that food, fun, and not even family can meet.
Right.
And we find that in Jesus. And I'm just curious for both of you, that's always been true. But how does it affect us today? You know, what do you see in the state of our culture? What do you see us looking for satisfaction? Sort of those false narratives, the things that we go after. How does it apply today, I guess?
Yeah, you know, I think there's the classic examples that, you know, we often talk through about, like, you know, fame, prestige, wealth. And I think those are certainly a part of that. I often wonder if there's a deeper, you know, a deeper longing that, that is really just manifesting in those ways. And I think it's a sense of meaning and coherence, right? In a world that, in a world like ours, that's really built on those idols, right? Of wealth, prestige, power, influence, fame, all within the availability of like an instant with, you know, kind of with the digital world and the way the internet has sped up everything. That there's, I think there's a deeper, like their lives don't make sense in the way our world is constructed if everything isn't up and to the right. If they're not always growing, deepening, earning more, this or that. Like, because in some ways those idols, you know, like let's take something like wealth. Wealth is actually relatively neutral as far as its morality. Right. You know, obviously, you can maybe earn money in less moral ways than others, but at its essence, it's neutral. And what happens, I think, is when you have this sense of when I find meaning in my tax bracket, what's happening there is you're finding coherence in which your life makes sense in a world that preaches the good ones, the good people are those who've earned more. And so what's really beneath the surface is a sense of meaning, a sense of how does my life make sense? And you know, so I think of like folding back in what we talked about with the disciples, when all of a sudden they're having to go and feed the Gentiles and interact with the Gentiles there, that wasn't coherent. That didn't make sense in the world that they lived in, because that was, they were off limits. They were the marginalized. They're on the outside. And Jesus is saying, your world may be set up that way. He says, but that ultimately, that's going to break down. That's not how this world operates, the world I've created, the kingdom of God. And so when Jesus then is pushing them in that uncomfortable space, I think he's actually allowing them to find a different story to live into that that brings genuine meaning. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's why I think money doesn't satisfy that longer ache, is because we've bought the myth that money means more power, influence, identity, and you can make sense of that in the kind of in the American world we live in. That's where we find meaning and purpose. But there's something deeper in which Jesus says you're not made for that. And so it's I think it's a quest for coherence, identity, to understand ourselves in the world around us, which I think is part of why what's so beautiful about, you know, anything through, you know, what God is doing is, yes, we have an individual connection with him, but it's about the formation of a different kind of people, in which our life makes sense. Then when we take on these counter practices, these counter ways of living, it makes sense within the context of that kind of counter community. So I think there's something in there. Like, again, I think it's a search for identity that manifests in a thousand different ways. But ultimately it's that, like, who am I in this world, and what is, how do I find my source of meaning?
I was talking to a friend, a little while back who, he is on this online dating quest and I'm hearing about all the different people that he's dating. I mean, I don't know. I haven't,
it's, you know, so brutal. I can't,
I haven't
imagine.
Dated yeah. since I got married, but I can't imagine what it would be like dating in this world.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
He keeps going on these dates and, you know, kind of like barely starting relationships, and then they blow up for whatever reason. And we just had this conversation, like, and it came down to like, man, what do you want? What do you really want? Because I feel like there's, you think you want this, and so you keep going after it the same way over and over again. But maybe it's not this that you want. Maybe it's over here somewhere. And that's kind of what you're getting at a little bit, right? With this satisfaction. We think sometimes that we are, I think you've called them misguided longings.
Disordered loves.
Yeah.
Which is Augustine's words, not mine, but.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah. And, so I just see in so many of my friends, you know, Jesus followers and not Jesus followers that have these sort of, you know, what did you call them?
Disordered loves.
Disordered loves.
Which is, I think, really good language, because it isn't like for your friend when he does, or if he does find a significant other, a spouse or whatever that relationship may turn into, it's not wrong to love that person. Right. But it's getting the proper ordering of those loves. Because again, that's in the same sense of like, you know, a bike is meant to be used in a particular way, in a particular manner. you could use that bike for a thousand different things, but it's probably not going to be as good of a use unless it's used in the way it was designed. In the same way of the human soul, like there's an ordering of which we're to love and to place our affections. And then when we distort that, well, then of course the soul gets a little bit broken and fractured because we're using it in a manner that it wasn't designed for. And so that's where that idea of disordered loves, I think, is really important.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think this is one of the graces of growing older. I mentioned earlier that, you know, part of growing older is dealing with loss and dealing with a series of losses, in essence, throughout life. And, you know, on the one hand, we look at that as negative and hard and so forth. But on the other hand, this may be the way that God sort of weans us from all those things, whether it's wealth, power, fame, success. I mean, as you get older, you kind of have less and less of those things to fall back on. And I actually been reading a book called From Strength to Strength, and by a fellow named Arthur Brooks. And the subtitle of the book is Finding Success, Happiness, and Deep Purpose in the Second Half of Life. And his whole deal, it's very interesting, but he has a whole chapter and it's called Chipping Away. And basically he talks about how as you get older, you have to sort of chip away all the props that you utilized as a younger person to bring sort of meaning and purpose and significance to your life. Wow. And you have to be intentional about actually chipping those things away. You know, and it's really very interesting, but I do think that especially, you know, for a Christ-centered person, as you get older and as things are chipping away from you, those things that used to, you know, for me, 35 years, you know, a whole bunch of my identity and worth was found in being the pastor at CPC. Let's be honest, you know, well, I don't have that anymore. That's been chipped away from my life. And so what do I do with that? You know, and I think that it's possible to find deep satisfaction apart from those things. And that's part of what the passage was all about, I think, this past weekend.
Yeah, there's so much of, I love, Mark, the way you reflected on that and experiencing that. And it's like, as a younger person, I wish somehow I could like expedite that process, right? Like, because so much of formation happens through suffering, through loss. Like, those are the moments in which God refines us so well. And that's fascinating. I've never thought through that idea of aging itself as a, I've thought of it as a refinement and a maturity process, but not as much as like you're saying of dealing with loss. Like it's almost forced. I don't know if suffering is too strong a word, but that forced loss where you are no longer, can you hide behind like youth and all those sorts of things.
Right.
And there's a natural progression, you know, if we're focused and intentional with our aging, I would imagine that will almost naturally bring a deeper formation as long as we don't refuse it. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, and so much of our culture is about refusing that aging process. That's interesting.
You know, what's interesting, Mark, is, you know, I can think of a particular church. I won't name it right now, but I've seen, speaking of this, pastors that have been at churches for 30, you know, 40 years and it's time to transition. And I've seen them do opposite of what you did, where they put a death grip on the church and the new leader. And not only do they stay, but they can't, it's almost like they can't bear to let go of that identity.
Right.
Like, no, this is still me. This is still mine. And you see what it does. Like it kind of forever traps them. So just another testament to your leadership that, that you're humble enough to let that go is pretty amazing. So looking at how we might apply something like this, that you say that he offers full and satisfying life to all people. That was kind of your main thing.
And it gets distributed through us.
Oh, did I miss part of your
main? That was part of the big idea.
Sorry.
Just so you know.
And it gets. So I guess maybe one of my main question, and this is for me and all of the thousands of people that are listening to this podcast right now. How do we, do you have any like best practices? How do we offer this to people? Like, yeah. If we have believers have found this, so we need to continue to embrace it. Like you said, we need to keep coming back to Jesus like the disciples did. So I don't think we can ever say I'm done with that part. Like, we always need Jesus and we always need to be aware of our need. But when it comes to offering that, which was a big part of what you were talking about, offering that to other people, do you have any like best practices? Like, what should we do? Like, how do we, what could be a next step for us to offer this satisfaction that Jesus, this bread that Jesus is offering for other people?
That's a really good question. Gosh, I mean, I think that, I think one of the things that we all can do is just, slow down and keep our eyes open and really, look for the opportunities that God is putting before us. And then move into them, you know, with prayer and with faith. And I think that, there's a lot of opportunities that get passed by each day because we're just moving so fast and we're trying to get whatever it is we're doing done and thinking about what we got to do after that, that we just kind of miss, we miss the people in the process. And so I think that's just one thing, you know, is just a heightened awareness, a slowing down of, you know, it's amazing how a conversation can begin. I was at the bank recently and I was making a deposit of some checks that had been given to the Bay Area School of Ministry. And I couldn't believe it, but the teller like asked me, well, what's the Bay Area School of Ministry? And, you know, I mean, he had all kinds of questions and I thought, are you supposed to do that? But, but you know, I mean, like I had this opportunity to talk with him about what we're doing and he seemed pretty excited about it. So, you know, that's just one thing that I would say is important to do.
I love that.
You know, I was thinking, I really like that too. And I'm thinking you can't, there's no, the best meals you've ever eaten were never efficient. They were never quick.
Right.
Right. Like inherently fast food is not as good as going to a nice restaurant and sitting down for a meal. Like, and I love the way you're mapping onto that. The idea of, again, like if we can't slow down, particularly with our, with our eyes open, we miss that. You miss that. Like you can't rush. There's nothing efficient about relationships. And I think we have to dispel that. I think it's spot on. I love that.
I don't want to miss what Siri just said to you on Mark's watch. She said, knowledge is good.
How do I control her? Will somebody help me?
I'll tell you what I did, Mark. Yeah. I don't know where, which direction your crown is.
Yeah.
But when my crown was facing my,
okay,
my hand, yeah, I would constantly pinch it.
Oh.
And that maybe sets her it off.
Oh.
Here's okay what I finally did. I just switched watches.
Kevin just abandoned the Apple Watch.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you for that. Yeah.
Wisdom bomb from Brandon Passion right there.
And I think too, you know, like, I had an interesting experience. I don't know. This is just an example of a deal that happened to me. So, I think it was maybe, December 23rd or 4th. Lynn and I were in Colorado visiting our daughter and her family there. And actually we were in bed and she was asleep. And I was just about ready to turn the light off. I'd been reading and go to sleep. And I got a text. And I got a text from an old friend who lives out in Colorado, who said basically that his son and daughter-in-law were traveling from L.A. to Denver. And they got stuck in Oakland. And you guys remember the whole Southwest Airlines thing and that deal where, you know, half the country was stuck in an airport. And he said, they have no hotel. They have nowhere to go. They're stuck in Oakland. They never travel. So this is a whole new thing for them. And would it be possible for them to take an Uber to your house in San Carlos and stay there? And my first thought was, you know, like... Like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Like, you know, like just find a place to stay around Oakland. You know, it's like, you're going to take an Uber all the way from Oakland to San Carlos. You're going to stay in my house.
And Uber is going to cost just as much as the flight.
Yeah. And my dog is there. What are they going to do with my dog and everything? I'm thinking, this is crazy. And then it just hit me that, Mark, yes.
Wow.
I mean, do it.
Yeah.
And so
now I know who to call if I'm ever stuck in Oakland.
So I said, yes. I didn't even ask Lynn, didn't wake her up. I said, absolutely. Well, they ended up staying there for almost 3 days.
Wow.
Because they couldn't get out.
Yeah.
And this is a young couple who doesn't know the Lord.
Mm.
And they were so incredibly overwhelmed with gratitude.
Wow. Mm.
And not only were they, but also their parents, who I was in contact with there in Denver. And it was just I'll tell you what, that was the best part of my Christmas.
Wow.
Was the satisfaction that came out of that. Yeah. In fact, this couple who I'm talking about, who live in Denver, old friends of ours. So we invited them to church on Christmas morning on Christmas Eve. His wife really doesn't go to church, and she came.
Mm.
And she came because she wanted to thank us, because it meant so much to her that we would do that for her kids. Now, I know that's, I don't mean to be tooting my own horn here, because we didn't hardly do anything, but you know, it just was like one of those opportunities that God puts in front of you that, you know, thankfully I said yes to, and it ended up being hugely satisfying and a huge blessing for a lot of people. So that's just an example of what we're talking about.
Mark, this makes me think I actually really need to borrow your Accord. I have a lunch meeting and my tire's flat.
Well, you can borrow my Accord if I can borrow your Tesla.
Okay, just set the record straight. I don't have a Tesla, everybody.
Yeah. Right. No, that's right. You were going to get a Tesla.
I thought about it.
Yeah, and then I kind of talked to you out of it, right?
You said nobody will ever let you live it down if you buy a Tesla.
That's right, yeah.